or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
We have a guest who we have in London, and we're having a little trouble getting in touch with him, but he's a great guest, so I'm going to, let me give you the number, Joanne, and you're going to come in. Okay. Well, I will tell you what we're up to. His name is Guy Kawasaki. He was one of the early Apple employees. He was chief evangelist for the Mac, and he went on to co-found Garage.com, which provided matchmaker services for angel investors and entrepreneurs. And that morphed into Garage Technology Ventures. But then he turned to becoming an expert in-person and especially online networking. And he wrote his latest book, he's written nine, called Enchantment, The Art of Changing Hearts, Minds, and Actions. And indeed, he's changed hearts, minds, and actions in his previous appearance on the show. So what I've done, what I rarely do, which is I invite a guest to return. Today, my peripatetic guest happens to be traveling, so as I said, he is in London. But we had him on the line, but we've lost him. No. So we're going to, as soon as Joanne can get a break, we'll have Joanne try to call him. Nobody's going to have a break, so we're not going to have him. Is he there?
I'm here.
Oh, you are here. I don't know why we lost you. Well, I'm delighted that you're here. Something had happened, but glad you're back.
I don't think you ever lost me.
Well, I put you on hold, and then I said, guy, no guy, and I thought that we had lost you. But delighted to have you back on Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Good. Well, everyone knows that the key to being enchanting, at least one first step, is the nice smile. But, you know, how do you make your smile look natural? The last thing we want is that phony salesman's smile.
Well, the easiest way to make sure you have a sincere smile is to sincerely be happy. Sounds like kind of a duh-ism, but that's the truth. The kind of smile that you want is called a Duchenne smile. Mm-hmm. And a Duchenne smile uses twice the number of muscles. It uses both the jaw muscles, which a fake smile uses, but it also uses the eye muscles. And it's the kind of twinkling and crow's feet that you see with George Clooney, with the great smilers of the world. And one consequence of this is the good news that you actually want crow's feet, so you shouldn't pay for surgery and
right.
various treatments.
Right. You know, you said something very interesting as prefatory to that, which is you said the best way to have a natural smile is to be happy. And indeed, some of it, you know, as some of the, you know, some people would say, you know, you're as happy as you want to be. But there is also the truth. There are some people who are constitutionally upbeat, and there are constitutionally people who are mildly depressed or sad or simply phlegmatic. It's just a large, significant percentage of the population. What advice would you give to the person who is constitutionally flat or even mildly depressed as to not give off those bad vibes that when we meet somebody who's kind of got that dour look or sad look, you know, we get turned off to them. Any advice to that segment of the population?
Marty, I wish I could tell you that on a phone call or with a $20 book, I could tell you how to cure unhappiness.
Right. Tall order.
Because, Marty, if I could, I would charge a lot more for the book. So basically, enchantment is built on three pillars: likability, trustworthiness, and quality. And I don't want people to have the impression that enchantment, the quality, is something you're born with or you're not. I think, sure, there are some people who are naturally enchanting, but people should look at enchantment as they do at fitness, which is you could be born with Lance Armstrong level fitness, but no matter how much fitness you're born with, you can always change your habits of eating and exercise and become more fit. So people can become more fit, they can become more enchanting.
So, yes, so certainly some of it is indeed changeable. I want to, and we're going to get to all three of those kind of legs of your enchantment stool. But you wrote something that was pretty interesting. It said, adopt a yes attitude.
Yes.
And yet when I read, I've read too many books, frankly, on management. They kind of, at this point, making my eyes glaze over. But when I read those books, some advice that's ubiquitous, which is, you know, you need to hire at least some people who will disagree with you and not be a yes man. You say adopt a yes attitude. Is there a risk of adopting a yes attitude?
Well, I think most obvious or most logical risk is, what if you adopt a yes attitude and people expect you and want you to do things that you don't want to do, you shouldn't do, et cetera, et cetera. And this is one of those things where I don't think you should take this rare exception and blow it into the common occurrence and therefore not do something. So what I'm saying is I have adopted the yes attitude for, I don't know, the past couple decades, and I'll tell you that the number of times that people wanted me to do something unreasonable is just a handful. And arguably, in those instances, those people were probably not worth enchanting.
Sure. That's a different situation. I'm going to talk about it. I'll use an I statement here. I have this kind of core, perhaps until this moment, unconscious belief that we add value to the extent to which we change things. And if we are, let's say we're dealing with our boss, and we're simply saying, yes, great idea, boss, that's terrific, good idea, and we're adding relatively little value. If instead we tactfully, while doing what we can to preserve the person's self-esteem, we say, you know, I understand what you're saying, but, and each time you're not saying yes, you're adopting a no attitude. No, I don't think this is quite right. Don't you ultimately add more value?
But these are two different instances. So when I say adopt the yes attitude, I mean that you should always be thinking when you meet other people that you have a default positive attitude that whatever they ask, I will probably say yes to. So you're thinking, you know, I just met Marty. What could I do to make his life better? Could I send out a tweet telling people to listen to his radio show?
Right.
You know, what could I do to help Marty? That's very different than if Marty asked me, you know, am I brilliant, good-looking, skinny, humorous? You're saying yes and lying. That's not what I'm saying.
Okay. I want to, you know, you've written about this stuff for so long, both from a voyeuristic perspective as well as, I think, maybe to get you to your current best practices. If you yourself, Guy Kawasaki, was meeting somebody first time, and you're trying to impress him, let's say President Obama or, you know, somebody even more lofty than you, right? Is there anything other than that nice smile and adopting a yes attitude? Is there anything else you would make sure to do in those first critical minutes?
In the first critical minutes, I would demonstrate that I have done some work in advance to understand who you are. Now, you said President Obama, and I think that's unrealistic. Let's just say that you're meeting, you know, a person, perhaps a person who's potentially important to you.
Like the editor of Rand. Let's say you were meeting, you know, this last book, Enchantment, was published by Penguin. Let's say you had an opportunity at a cocktail party to meet the decision maker at Random House. And so what would you try to do in those first few minutes beyond the nice smile, adopt the yes attitude? What would you do in that cocktail party few minutes with the executive editor of Random House?
I would look into his background or her background and figure out what they did. So, for example, let's say that editor was Tom Peters' editor, mm-hmm. or let's say that editor was Malcolm Gladwell's editor, mm-hmm. or let's say that editor came from a newspaper publishing background, or for that matter, you know, can you find something about the interests of that editor? Maybe that editor is a world-class golfer or world-class hockey player, or that editor has adopted children. So there's a lot of ways you can look for something that mm-hmm. you can agree on.
So you'd Google them, and that would get you probably enough nuggets to get you started.
Well, between Google and there's a site called Spokeo, S-P-O-K-E-O. You can enter a person's email address, and it'll go out and look at all the public areas that person's email address is affiliated with and come back and tell you that this is the person's Facebook presence, this is the person's Flickr presence, this is the person's Twitter presence. Now, it can get creepy. So, you know, when you meet this person, I wouldn't go up to the person and say, listen, I hear you have four children. They're ages 16, 18, 22, and 25.
Right.
And the 25-year-old is now getting her PhD at Brown University. That's a little creepy.
Right.
In fact, that's a lot creepy.
Right.
So you have to be careful that you don't overstep the boundary. But I think, you know, anybody would be flattered if you met someone and they said, oh, didn't you edit Tom Peters, you know, In Search of Excellence?
Yep.
That's a pretty good opening.
Sounds good. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Guy Kawasaki. He is my favorite person on the planet in terms of how to make connections, both in person and online. His latest of his 9 books is Enchantment, The Art of Changing Hearts, Minds, and Actions. When a stranger, let's flip it around a little bit. Let's say, you appear to be a pretty social guy. When you meet, let's say a stranger meets you, say, at one, you've given a keynote address at a conference. And, you know, so often people, you know, they don't want to just meet celebrity. They want to use you in one way or another, get a lead, get a job, something. Other than what you've already mentioned, is there anything that a person could do in that minute or two that would make you want to at least continue the conversation? For example, inviting them, hey, why don't you give me a call?
Besides, they obviously should be likable and, you know, or appear to be likable, trustworthy. The next thing is...
How? And other than what we've said so far, is there anything else?
Well, I mean, not other than what we've said so far. It is about the handshake and the smile. And, you know, it would be good if there were some way that I could judge the person's likability and trustworthiness, perhaps using a proxy, like using a reference that one of my friends... current friends suggested that we meet or something like that.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, give me something to feel more comfortable. In my case, you know, just tell me you use a Macintosh.
Is that really true? If I came up, let's say I didn't know one of your buddies, and I'm like, I use a nice smile, a nice handshake, and, you know, I say, I got to tell you, I know you way back from when you were a Mac evangelist, and I use a Mac too. What would I need to do next? To get to, that's not going to take me to the level where you're going to say, give me your phone call, give me your phone number, or I'll call you, or vice versa. What's the next thing that they need to do to put them over the edge so that you'll say, yeah, let's talk?
Well, I hate to tell you, but I practice what I preach, and I do default to yes. So unless you came off extremely unlikable, extremely untrustworthy, just basically a pain in the ass, I would probably tell you, okay, you know, here's my email address, because I am defaulting to yes. So, you know, the pitch would be better if you said, I'm a longtime Macintosh user. I admired your work at Apple. I've read many of your past books. My favorite was Rules for Revolutionaries. I also play hockey, and I've adopted children. You know, you're pretty much, yeah, okay, buddy. I mean,
right.
You're my best friend.
Right. Okay, let's... I like to be personal because, again, it gets your current thinking. So right now, how are you allocating your networking time? For example, among Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Google+, and, of course, various forms of in-person networking. How are you allocating your time these days?
I'm almost afraid to admit this. I would say roughly 95% of my social networking time. And don't get me wrong, that's 95% of probably 30% of my total time.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, a lot
is
spent on Google+.
Interesting. Tell us why and what you do with it.
Well, with Google+, I can have conversations with intelligent strangers who I've never met. So they're not my friends and family from Facebook.
Let's back up. Tell us, many people still are first figuring out how to best use Facebook. Tell us, what is Google+, and then how you use it.
Okay. So Google+ is a way that you can meet people who have the same passions with you, and you can engage them in conversations using photos, using video. So it is very much like Facebook, except Facebook has your friends and family, and if you're young, parents on it. Twitter, it's also similar to Twitter, except it's superior to Twitter because you can have inline pictures. And you are obviously not limited to 140 characters. It's something like 100,000 characters. So you can have long, meaningful content going on with these people. And one of the big advantages that Google Plus has over Twitter and Facebook is that after you make a comment or after you post a message, you can always edit it. And I don't know about you, but I edit almost every post after the fact.
Me too. I like doing that. But how is that different? You know, obviously LinkedIn has discussion groups, and of course there are all kinds of Yahoo discussion groups, etc. How is Google Plus different from the many online discussion groups that are indeed topic-centric?
The online discussion groups are primarily sort of a group discussion, you know, feeding frenzy, multiple, if not hundreds of people commenting on the topic. This is different because this is initiated by one person. It can be seen, obviously, by all the people who follow you or circle you, but you're not putting it out into a forum where everybody's leaping in. And so it's a little different. I think it's much more focused, probably lower noise level. And also, I think you tend to have followers who have the same orientation towards an issue that you do. So, for example, if you went into a political forum and you said, you know, Herman Cain should drop out or Herman Cain should not drop out, if you went into a political forum, you know, roughly half the people would be telling you you're great and insightful. The other half would be telling you you're stupid and, you know, you should be killed. So by contrast, with Google+, people have self-selected. So if you're a Herman Cain supporter, you probably have followers who are also of the same ilk.
Okay, and so just mechanically, forgive my stupidity here, because I don't use Google+, how would I even go about finding a group that from whom I would be compatible, or do I start one? How did you do it? How did you, when you walk me back to your virginal days when you were a Google Plus virgin, you know, what did you do?
In the backseat of a car.
Right, exactly. And what did you do? Step, you know, how did you find out about it? What did you first do? What did you do?
The truth is that when I first tried Google Plus, I posted a message, and nobody responded to it. And so for a while, I thought, well, Google Plus is, you know, it's kind of a loser thing. I mean, you know, I post this message, nobody says anything. And it took me about 4 or 5 days to figure out that the reason why very few people were responding to me was because, believe it or not, I had turned on privacy so that nobody could see the post.
That'll do it.
Yes, that'll do it.
So but how do you even find it? Well, how do you start? What is the first thing you do?
In my case, Marty, and it's not true for everybody, because I had this life prior to Google Plus, I was very visible as soon as I got on there. Mm-hmm. This is not going to be true for many other people.
Okay, so let's go back to me. So Marty Nemko is an idiot around Google Plus, and Marty Nemko cares a lot about career issues. So what, click by click, what does Marty Nemko do? If I want to, after this radio show, I want to go home and I want to start having a time-effective, useful use of Google Plus. I care about career issues. What should I do?
Okay, so this assumes you've already joined, right?
Well, you can join just by going to google.com or something, and you join.
Yeah, basically. Yeah,
I've got a Google account. I got a Gmail account, if that's what you mean.
Okay, so, you know, you're practically in already. And so the first thing I would do if I were you would be go to Google Plus and type in the keywords for your area of interest. And in your case, it might be career or human resources or professional development. So you type in words like that, and this will yield results where people have posted about the topic.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at these posters, these people who initiated these threads, and you say, this is a person who is intelligent, and I want to follow or circle this person.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that on, you'll see what that person is posting.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing you do is you take a post of a person who looks interesting, and you go and you read the comments, and there might be 50 or 60 comments to this person's post, and you can see which commenters seem intelligent and agreeable and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So not only is the post a way to find a good person, the comments to the post also indicate, you know, what kind of people these commenters are. And so you start following them, and then you start commenting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you're in the flow, you get more visible, people will start following you, and you build up a platform.
Great. That was a really good, clear presentation. I am talking with Guy Kawasaki. The little soundbite I'm going to give him, he's my personal favorite guy about making connections. He knows how to do it online, in person. His latest book is Enchantment, The Art of Changing Hearts, Minds, and Actions. You know, it's amazing that we have already evolved to the point where Guy Kawasaki, you know, Facebook was the killer app, if there ever was one, of the first half of the 21st century, and yet Guy Kawasaki is now saying he spends 95% of the 30% of his work week working on Google Plus. He hasn't mentioned Facebook. Is, from career standpoint, if many of my listeners are very career minded, they could be well employed, marginally employed, unemployed. What role do you see in the year 2012 Facebook playing if you're trying to use it as a career tool, which that is certainly it's evolved from just being a social tool?
Well, whether you are focusing on Facebook, and you know, it's not clear that everybody should focus on Google Plus like I am.
Hmm.
I happen to have some advantages.
Who should and shouldn't? Who should and who should not be focusing on Google Plus?
Well, 6 years ago, if someone said to you, there's this new thing that a lot of college students are on called Facebook, mm-hmm. and I think you should get on Facebook. Let's say you're a 40-year-old, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. You're a middle manager in a large company, and somebody said, there's this thing called Facebook, and lots of college students and high school students are on it. I think you should get on it. Who among us 5 or 6 years ago would say, oh, yeah, makes perfect sense.
Right.
I'll join that.
Not many.
Not many. None, in fact. And so that's kind of where we are with Google Plus.
Hmm.
Now, Google Plus is not from two guys in a garage with $250,000. This is from Google, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Google is the 8-million-pound gorilla.
Right.
And it owns this river called search.
Uh-huh.
And so imagine, Marty, if one day Google decides, well, when someone types the word career in Google search, the results will come back, and we're going to put the people who are focused on discussing careers in the top part of the search.
Now I get it, really get it.
And
I
then,
see.
So let's say, let's just, you know, pretend we'll fantasize for a second.
Mm-hmm.
So you become an expert on Google Plus on careers. So now in the sidebar, in the promoted area, I mean, someplace mm-hmm. Google decides, okay, so we're going
right.
to display three people who are really known for their career
right.
discussions on Google Plus.
Right.
So can you imagine how many times people search for career every day?
Right.
Probably
right.
about 2 million times, right?
Right?
And then of those 2 million, you know, I don't know, 10% will say, who's this guy Marty who's on the top of the search results here? I'll click on him. It'll change your life, Marty.
Got it, but what's going through my little brain says, you know, there's something Darwinian about the whole thing. It's like today, in order to survive, you have to be the winner. I mean, like you say, there are going to be 10 million people trying to create career presences using Google Plus, just like there were 10 zillion people trying to create career presences using Twitter. And it's like you're spending more and more of our time on marketing. Yes, it's ever more effective, but does it feel like it's a race, you know, where there's only going to be a few winners and everybody else is going to be losers because you have to be so good and so sophisticated to be the one person or the five people who are going to be on the first page of the Google Plus results within Google search? Am I being too negative?
No, you're being realistic. I mean, that's what life is all about, right?
Oof.
I mean, what you just described is life.
Well, that's why the Occupy movement is calling for greater redistribution of resources to those who are not going to be able to win in that ever more Darwinian contest, right?
Well, good luck. I mean,
I know, it's tough.
There's a reason why giraffes have long necks. It's not because they protested. So, you know, you can believe that the system is unfair. You can believe the system is too hard. You can believe the system is anything, but the system is the system. Mm. So, you know, you can either cry and, you know, here's a quarter, call your mama up, or you can work your ass off and get to be in the top group, Marty. So that's my advice.
All right, let's turn to your books.
Okay.
You know, one of the many things I admire about Guy Kawasaki, and there really are a lot, is the way, of course, you market your books. For example, you hold contests. You held a contest design the cover of Art of the Start, which now a decade later remains in my mind the most memorable cover I've ever seen. It was a lighted match, mm-hmm. which was exactly right. It was brilliant, and it was rendered gorgeously. Your current book, Enchantment, is brilliant. The idea of a butterfly that is kind of a little edgy or whatever, which you custom, you kind of photoshopped or whatever you had custom created, is a very, very memorable cover. And you ran you're running a contest for who could create the best JPEG of somebody holding the cover of Enchantment. I mean, that's a genius. And what's the prize? Simply a signed cover. What's a non-obvious but important piece of marketing advice for the authors of books, including today, self-publishing is really smart, self-publishing on CreateSpace or ebooks. What's some marketing advice you have for book writers?
The best marketing advice I can give a book writer is, before your book comes out, establish yourself as an expert in that niche on Twitter or Facebook or Google Plus.
Wow.
And, I think at this point you have to assume that if you are self-publishing,
right.
then believe it or not, you don't have anybody else to blame. I mean, in the old world where you had a book publisher out of New York, you could always complain, oh, my publisher doesn't do enough marketing.
Right. Okay. I have said that a number of times.
Okay. So that's the old days, and maybe you were justified in saying it because the publisher was keeping 80% and you were getting 20%.
I got less than 20%. Continue.
Okay, but now in the new world, if you are the self-publisher, so the good news is now you're keeping 80% and you're paying 20%. Yep. Life is better. However, with that comes a lot more work and responsibility. So now you don't have a publisher to complain about nor depend on. You are the entrepreneur. So you have to think of your book as a product, and you have to roll it out, and you have to get people to buy it. You have to run contests. You have to do whatever it takes. So, the reason why you're now making 80% is not because you deserve it. The reason is because you're going to work a lot harder.
Right. So you made a point. Right. You run contests, do whatever. So I'd like one or two specific tips beyond contests. Let's say I've done what I've said. Let's say my little, to use Seth Godin's term, we're all weird. We're going to use a long tail approach. I'm going to be an expert in some little narrow niche. Let's say I'm going to become an expert at doing career coaching for disgruntled physicians. Okay. And I've Google Plus. I've created a Google Plus presence and a Twitter presence, and I'm branded. Okay, now I've written my book called The 10 Things That Every Disgruntled Physician Must Know. Now, what would be your one or two best tips on how to now generate more sales of my book?
So we've established yourself as an expert, right?
Right.
So that's 90% of the battle. And now you need to milk that positioning. So a very good model for you to have in mind is NPR. I hope I can use. Can I use NPR on your show?
We are NPR. Go ahead.
Oh, you are? Okay.
We are an NPR affiliate here in San Francisco.
Okay, good. So, in my mind, the way NPR works is.
You notice we haven't had any commercials. This is.
That's true. I didn't even think about that.
Exactly right. Okay, go ahead.
So, for 52 weeks a year, NPR has great content, right?
Right.
Has your stuff, has Wait, Don't Tell Me, Fresh Air,
exactly.
Tech Nation, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Moira
so
Gunn.
You love this content. You love Moira Gunn. You
right.
love you. You love Terry Gross. You
right.
love Moira Gunn. And now, every once in a while, NPR runs this thing called The Telethon.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you that anybody likes to listen to The Telethon.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Fun drives.
Yeah. Operators are standing by.
Yes, they are.
We couldn't have NPR if it weren't for your donation.
That's
Call
right.
in now. The people at Procter & Gamble are going to match you up to $1,000.
Exactly.
And for $10 a month, you're going to get the free solar phone charger.
Exactly.
Right? So now, but if anybody else did a telethon, you'd be saying, spammer.
Right.
I don't want anything to do with this organization, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But it happens that, at least in my mind, NPR, because it provides such great content, has earned the right to advertise.
True. All good statements. Continue.
And so it has earned this right, and so now I will support it. I will support it by letting it advertise. I will even donate. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key mental model, that you have to earn the right to promote things.
Mm-hmm. So very concretely, in this case, you would be very wise if you are, say, you're an author, and you are a believer in NPR as well. During their pledge drive, you donate your book, 10 copies of your book, signed autographed copies of the book. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
I would do whatever it takes. People have to really, you have to embrace that kind of attitude. Now, I'm not saying you should do unethical things, but in this world of a flattened world where, you know, it's one degree of separation between you and anybody else in the world, you have to embrace a different attitude, and it's not top-down anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't let your future, your book sale in this case, be dictated by the whims of, you know, people in high places in New York.
Mm-hmm. You know, I also think that the whole way the pricing of books has got to change. Content has become a commodity. And so to charge $29.95 for a book, you're setting yourself a pretty high bar. You actually, I think, a year or two ago, told me about the strategy of charging $2.99 for a book. And that may be, in this world, that's the kind of an amount of money that everybody would feel is a very fair amount to provide, say, 100 pages worth of really fresh, good content. Is pricing a critical component of this, too?
I wish it weren't so much, but the answer is yes.
Right. Go ahead. All right. Let me ask you, look, we're out of time, so let me ask you one last question. This is a macro question. In these tight times, everyone is feeling, gee, we better be wise to reallocate some of my work time to, you know, what you can call it, enchantment, you can call it networking, whatever it is. But in terms of the nation, I worry that that reallocation of time from working on the, you know, your work, the product, being productive, you know, contributing, to you're reallocating that to the gift wrapping, to the, you're turning, instead of focusing on the steak, you're focusing on the sizzle. Do you worry about that at all?
Oh, Marty, you're killing me. You are freaking killing me. You're talking to a branding and marketing person,
right?
You're saying I'm the gift wrapping? Oh, hurt me, Marty.
But you know, you're also a very circumspect guy. You know, do you worry about that ratio?
Not at all.
Why?
Well, I mean, the total picture is that this is called Guy's Golden Touch. Okay, so Guy's Golden Touch, first of all, is not whatever I touch turns to gold. Guy's Golden Touch is whatever is gold the guy touches. And so I have tried to enchant people with great stuff, and I have tried to enchant people with crap, and it is a lot easier to enchant people with great stuff. So it I don't think you should try to separate, oh, let's have great stuff with no marketing or crappy stuff with great marketing. You need to have both in this world. That's just the way it is. And the primary example of this, of course, is Apple. Apple has great, great products, and it has great marketing. So, you know, that's kind of the theoretical best case. But I don't think, whether you like it or not, that I think is the case because of the Internet, because of Twitter and Facebook and Google+. You know, everybody is a critic today, but also everybody can be an evangelist.
Well, thank you very much, Guy Kawasaki, for being a most eminent, I guess that's a fair, you're finally old enough, Guy, we can call you eminent, evangelist for things marketing, and giving me part of your Sunday, no less, while you were traveling in London. So the book, of course, is Enchantment, The Art of Changing Hearts, Minds, and Actions. Anything else you want to plug, Guy, before I let you go?
Well, right now, if you buy Enchantment, you can get a free copy of Presentation Zen by Gar Reynolds. And that is a great book about making great presentations. And I also do personalized covers. I'll personalize cover for anybody and send it anywhere in the world.
Wow. How do they get that? What do they do? Yes, you can.
You can go to GuyKawasaki.com.
Okay.
And you'll see the order information.
Great.
You order it. You tell me that you did. Proof of purchase. We'll send you an authorization to get presentations in, and we'll provide the link to getting the autographed copy. And if none of this makes sense to you, my email address is guy@alltop.com.
guy@alltop.com. Guy Kawasaki, thanks again for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you.
Be well. Okay, and now, my dear listeners, we turn to you. If you have a career problem of any sort, and I deliberately am just being very vague here, it can be any sort of career problem. You're welcome to call for what I call a, variably these days, a three-minute career makeover, a job tune-up, a workover. Got a career problem? I usually can give you at least a baby step in the right direction, whether you're self-employed, employed by others, or unemployed or underemployed. The phone number for such a free service is 415-841-4134. That's the number here at Work with Marty Nemco here on KALW, 415-841-4134. I want to share some ideas that have come across my desk. You know, those of you who listen know I've mentioned farmers markets periodically. I've been going to farmers markets for a long time. And in fact, sometimes in response to a caller, I will suggest that perhaps they sell their product. There's usually a food product or craft product or something like that at a farmers market. But in my recent months, as I've been going to farmers markets, and I go to a bunch of them because I kind of like trying out different ones, I've noticed a gradual change. I've noticed an increase in the number of vendors. There's ever more vendors there. And I'm seeing, while I'm still seeing a fair amount of people there, certainly, I'm seeing them buy less. I'm seeing fewer lines. I used to, for a while, there was at the produce places and at the handcrafted dessert places or whatever. There were like lines you would line up. Now it seems like people are kind of wandering and I'm not seeing a lot of shopping bags. So, you know, this is just like notes from the underground. This is like truly from the street. I may be wrong. I don't have statistics to say it. But if you're one of those people who is thinking about jumping on the bandwagon and selling your product in a farmer's market, you may want to think twice. This could be a fad that's fading, you know, like cigar stores in the 80s. You know, if you were one of the last ones on your block to open a cigar store, you're left pretty stuck. So just a little bit of something from a little personal experience. The phone number again, if you would like a 3-minute career makeover, got any kind of work problem, the number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. What's on your mind? It's your turn. Hello.
Yes, could you hear me?
Nice, perfectly.
Yes, my problem is essentially I've kind of been lost in a place where I worked. I work in my background is sales and business development. So unlike Guy, I'm not a marketing expert, but I would say that I'm pretty good at sales. And then about 10 or 15 years ago, I sort of lost interest in the corporate world. I'm sure you've heard that before.
I sure have.
And started off on my own, and I own a little training company. But I guess when I was trying to think real quickly, I was surprised I jumped on the phone so quick that, you know, what is my real problem? I've lost the kind of, I love to sell. I love sales, but I am not succeeding in small company doing it on my own business like I did in sort of the corporate world, and that I'm not willing to go work and be sort of like a wage slave for some tech guy, which I did for many years. And I don't have a monetary problem. I'm a pretty good investor. I don't have an issue where I can't make money. I know I'm skilled, but it's kind of like, is this all there is?
To what extent is the problem you're just sick and tired of selling training, and that maybe if there was something else you were more excited about, that you would be more motivated? To what extent is that the core problem?
That was the core problem, and about a year ago, year and a half ago, I signed a partnership with a company that they have a tremendous amount of variety, well beyond training. It could be, okay, you know, people development projects, cutting and doing things more efficiently, literally resources around the world. So I have a variety of things I can do. I think it's just I was so successful for so long and then not so, in my mind, not successful, that I'm feeling like I don't want to necessarily go back to the old way. You never can do that. But it's not just the training. I think maybe it's just sales itself. That I have to get excited about what I'm selling, and even though I've got a lot of a variety of what I've got, you know, it's the whole how do I put it? When you're in a corporate type environment, or where there's many, many more people around you, you're sort of spoon fed, and I guess I get tired of having to go out and find a chicken, kill it, and then grill it. I mean, I'm sorry to use the...
Got it. So which of the following feels more on target? Finding a partner or an employee where you can be synergistically motivated and you've got a little bit of structure, maybe somebody who's going to provide a complementary skill set, Or two, is this existential angst? You know, as sometimes we get older, we just say, is that all there is? Which of the two feels better of the two?
The former. I mean, if I have a partner, a business partner, maybe I'm getting a little tired of...
Right. So let's say you had a business partner, and would you rather have a business partner? Would you rather simply have an employee who works for you? Or would you rather join a, not a corporation, but a small firm or a small nonprofit? Which of those feels like a better starting place for the next part of our discussion?
The third.
Okay.
Join a small group.
Okay. And would it be a for-profit or nonprofit venture, or would it matter?
Doesn't matter.
Okay. And so... what do you give a crap about? What do you? Let's say I gave you $1 million, and you had to spend it by tomorrow. Would you invest it in a for-profit product service? Would it be? Would you give it to a nonprofit? What would you do with the money?
Good question. I'm in a couple. I'm in a couple places where we are philanthropic. We raise money and then we give it to people who need the money. But I don't feel part of that. So to answer your question, I like when you're a team manager and you can motivate and work with others and you make them better, you're not really the focus. You're not really the limelight. They are. But the team gets better as a whole. I like that aspect of business.
All right. I'm gonna throw out just one thing here for the heck of it.
Sure.
You know, I was shocked to read MSNBC. It's kind of, you know, it does obviously have a liberal bias, but I was surprised to read in MSNBC that they reported Bureau of Labor Statistics results that Since September 2011, 2007, while the total amount of employment in the U.S. has gone down quite a bit, the number of federal employees has gone up 30%, notwithstanding what they're all saying about cutting back. 15% in the executive branch and 12% overall. So notwithstanding all the budget problems, the federal government's budget is large and growing and growing. So if you started a business with a couple of people whose job simply is to get government contracts, and the reality is that one of the ways you get a big preference is having I don't know if you're a minority or not, and you know, I know you're not a woman, but having a minority partner is the most, or not the most, too strong, is a very potent way to increase your chances of getting the contracts. I have a client who works for General Electric, and they have separate people just simply to try to find minority contractors who can work with GE, and therefore they're going to be able to get more government contracts. If I said that your goal would be to find, to go and look at the Federal Register. The Federal Register is, it contains requests for quotations, which is, you know, what is the government going to spend money on? What do they want to buy from the private sector? Look through that to stir up ideas of what you might be excited to sell to the federal government. Then get a couple of partners, ideally one of whom would be a person of color, but also people who have complementary skill sets, and create that business. And you, like you say, be the motivator, and that your goal is you're going to try to get federal contracts. What do you like and not like about that idea?
Federal. I don't want anything to do with the government. Generally, I stay away from it. When I have a couple clients who sell into it, and I like to help them, but I don't. I just really everything government to me is kind of. I'm not talking about how my political views are. I just don't. It's just such a mess.
Okay. So, well, let's say we plug that out, and instead we plug in, you simply look through the index of your Yellow Pages, which is a nice way of looking at all the products and services that are sold locally in your area. And you use that to trigger an idea for something you probably never in a million years would have thought of, a product or service that somehow your intuition tells you you'd be more excited to sell. And you then assemble this team to do it. And you're going to be, as you say, you most enjoy motivating a team. If I said that that's what you need to do to refresh your kind of reinvigorate your interest in work, to what extent do you think that's on target?
Well, definitely the motivating a team is spot on. The Yellow Pages part, I'm not sure. I'm certainly the internet or whatever I need to
whatever.
Do.
Yeah, but look at...
I need to be closer to motivating a team. There's no question about that.
So looking, because I'm wondering whether a combination of a new product or service, as well as you're bringing in a couple of people and being primarily the motivator of them, might be a nice formula. And I don't care whether you're searching on the Yellow Pages or simply searching on Google Trends, which lists the most searched on terms on Google, or some business-to-business websites. But find a new something. Or maybe you're existing. Maybe you don't. Maybe there's no problem with you. Say there's a wide range of products and services that company you're working, you know, that's hired you to sell for them. Maybe you simply bring in a couple of people to join you in the effort to sell that diversified company's products. How does that sound?
I like it. Yeah,
all right.
I like that.
I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. As you see, I am not high stuck on making a 3-minute career make over 3 minutes. I thought we needed about 10, and so I gave it to him, and I will give you what you need as well. If you would like some career help, whether it be a 3-minute career makeover, a 10, or a 1, any kind of career problem, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. How can I help?
Anyway, my wife and I own a vending company. We lost our jobs in the construction industry. She does architecture. I was a contractor. And so she was fortunate enough to inherit some money. And I said, well, we need to go into something that I would consider a recession-proof business. So I saw an opportunity in the schools because of the State Bill 677 outlawed junk foods. In the schools, and provided a new definition of compliant foods for the school vending.
You mean ketchup is no longer a vegetable?
Oh,
just a small joke. Go ahead.
That depends on who you ask, I suppose.
Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, so there's a legal definition of the state bill. It's SB 677. Then there's a federal guideline too. But anyway, so we provide these healthier snack alternatives to children. And we have a particular problem right now. Last year, there's another company that provides the actual meals to the schools for the lunch program, and we just do the vending. Mm-hmm. So this other company.
So I have a picture of some broccoli stalks in your in a vending machine. I'm only half joking. What do you put in your vending machines?
We have our vending machines in schools from Oakland down to Fremont, and mostly East Bay. And anyway,
what do you put in
them? One of our schools in particular, you know, very, very fine school in Oakland, Oakland School for the Arts, a very, very fine school. It was actually built, Jerry Brown had a lot to do with the building of this school.
What do you put in the vending machines?
We put snack foods that are compliant under the 677 guidelines. Everything from baked chips to healthy cookies to things like vitamin water and other types of beverages that are 50% fruit juice, things like that.
Got it. So continue. So how can I help?
So we have a lot of brand name items and some that are not well known items. But anyway, so now the other company. The company that provides the lunch program, I don't know if I should name their name, but anyway, they provide the lunches. Now they're looking at us and they're saying, hey, that's a good idea. They're a much bigger company. It's a woman-owned company. Well, ours is a woman-owned company too, as it belongs to my wife. So now they basically, want to steal our thunder, and they want to get into the vending business, and they don't have any experience in it. And last year they called us and under the pretense of buying our business, and we said no, we're not interested in selling. And then they said, well, we'll pay you for a consultation, and that didn't happen. So basically, my wife got the idea they were just trying to pick her brain for free, and she wasn't about to do that. So, but now this year it turns out that they've kind of done an end run around us and trying to get their machines into the school and use it as an experiment. And
I'm going to interrupt you because I think I've got your point here. This is the American way. This is competition. And
right. The problem is though that they're using the school as an experiment. They have no experience in vending.
Got it. I'm going to interrupt you. Listen, for what it's worth. So you've got two choices. You can either decide that you are going to increase the quality of your product, the vending, the service, pricing, the marketing efforts, that is, talk to the schools and explain why you are better. That is what you're either going to choose to compete, which is doing one or more of those things, or you're going to say, you know what, they are well capitalized, they are actually smarter and more aggressive than you, and so this market is not going to be good for you, and you need to find another market. Do you want to compete with them, or do you want to get out from them?
We can better compete with them with the children. The thing is, we deal with a lot of personal biases. There are certain administrators that say, well, even though you're compliant, we still don't like what you're doing because everything in a Mylar bag is evil.
All right, so. I'm going to interrupt you because I want to take more calls. What you need to do is you need to make a list of all the objections you've currently gotten from companies. You need to request more information so that you know what you need to do to compete. And then you need to develop either a plan to compete successfully and implement it. And in which case you'll at least, if not dominate the market, continue to have a good market share. Or you're going to say, all this is not worth it. And that's my best advice, and I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi. My name is Michael.
Hi, Michael.
I guess if anyone knows me, they'll know who I am. I'm a woman named Michael.
I know another Michael. I know a Michael Cleland who used to be a producer at KGO.
Well, there you go. So my question is, I am near to finishing. I'll get my PhD later this year in a field in humanities. Mm-hmm. And so I'm on the job market right now, and I don't know how much you know about grad school and
a lot.
Academic job market. Yeah, so not good.
A lot.
It's not good at all. So I've put a lot of applications.
I'm
going
to make a little parenthetical remark before I let you go to question. Of course, that is one of the myriad ways in which I consider higher education one of the most unethical businesses in America. The amount of lack of disclosure that they give to prospective PhDs, not only in the humanities, where it's obviously bad, but in the sciences, we have a gross oversupply. If a doctor required people to take a 6 to 8 year long program, which cost a fortune, without disclosing the odds of it being successful, that doctor would be sued and lose in every court in the land. But higher education, not only do we not sue them when we for their lack of transparency, we simply give more financial. We vote to give more financial aid, which merely allows the universities to raise their tuition more. But I digress. Now, please continue.
Yeah, it's a saturated market, and they're troubled. Luckily, I don't have any debt, I've run out of funding. This is my eighth year, but I'm not in debt, so that's good. But the question is this. So these jobs, I have 16 applications out right now, but there'll be, no joke, 500 to 800 people applying for each of these jobs.
That's right.
So there's that. So here I am. I'm close to the end. I haven't been able to really consider Plan Bs while writing my dissertation because then it feels really pointless to be spending all my time writing a dissertation.
Yeah, you got to be motivated to get through all the crap of a dissertation. Don't worry about, focus on that. But for now in this phone call, so you're looking for a Plan B.
Well, no, so here's my thought. Any backup plan I start to get into, I've done art in the past as well, so I'm kind of an artist and teaching. I love teaching. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to ask you if you have suggestions or methods of ways that I could think through what I might want to do. I also have my parents own a small business, so I have a little bit of business background in that, like a little bit of know-how. So I start thinking about, maybe I could get out there and, not make a lot of money, but maybe support myself by doing art and this kind of thing. But I have a lot of fear about that,
sure.
And I don't know how to...
Right. Tell me, what's your dissertation on?
Big novels, 20th century novels in French, English, and Spanish. Sorry, I'm losing my voice.
So you like Proust, the Remembrance, 1,500 pages. Is that the kind of thing you like?
3,000. That's one of my chapters.
That's what I figured. Yes. Okay. And the War and Peace and the like. Okay. So I want to start with a specific plan for you, and I'm going to want you to tell me what you like and don't. What's your first name? Michael. That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Michael. Tell me what it scores on the Michael meter. And the Michael meter goes from 0 to 10, with 0 means the idea makes you puke, and 10 means it gives you ecstasy. Okay? So the idea is where the growth is, especially, I believe that President Obama is going to get reelected, and one of his major commitments is to increase funding for community college. He wants everybody to go to college, and therefore there's going to be relatively high hiring in community colleges. Mm-hmm. And in fact, while you're not going to be talking about Proust, War and Peace in a community college, nonetheless, a PhD in in literature, it's going to be one of the basic required kind of courses. So what you need to do is you need to demonstrate that you say you like teaching. You need to create a great video demo of you teaching. I don't know if you're a graduate teaching assistant or whatever. A great lesson in which you teach very simply. I don't want you talking about, you know, the very deep, complex uses of triple doppelgangers in the, you know, right? So, but something that would be appropriate for community college students. Okay. Use that as part of a portfolio that you would submit to community colleges. Network and build relationships with the chairs of the English departments at community colleges in geographic areas in which you're likely to live. On the side, you should always do your art, because every smart person usually needs some creative outlet. But don't, as you say, you're very nervous about that. Don't make your income contingent on that. Don't get sucked into small business. Nobody goes into a PhD in literature on the big novels if she wants to be in business. So if I said that should be the plan, what does that score on the Michael meter?
That sounds really great. That's actually part of a contingent plan already. I mean, it's the idea, you know, it sounds great to say network, build these relationships, but that's what seems a little hard. You were talking about how messed up the whole higher education system is. One of the things it's done for me in the non-positive way is that I've spent almost 8 years kind of feeding my worst tendencies. You know, I'm less engaging with people. I'm very isolated, you know. So
right. If you're reading 1,500 page books, you're not exactly you're working on Google Plus and schmoozing at parties.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So what I would encourage you to do is the following. Make a list of the 20 community colleges at which you'd most like to work. Mm-hmm. Find out the office hours of the department chair. If they are local, visit them during their office hours. Tell them your truth. In the end, we are in a world of BS. And so truth is refreshing. We all really lust after it. What is literature, after all? It is a search for the truth, the unspoken truth, the unseen, the unheard. So, you know, you will find a greater degree of resonance with at least the right kinds of department chairs. So go and meet with them. Tell them your truth. Tell them your fears. Tell them what you bring to the table. Show them the two-minute video of your teaching. And what you would do if you were brought into the department, how you'd become a wonderful contributing member of that department. And then don't ask for a job. Say, I'm scared. What would you suggest I do? You give your truth that way, intelligently, warmly, humanly, but also selling what you bring to the table, without overselling, to those 20 department chairs, and without having, you know, being a born networker, you will start relationship building, perhaps with one or two, so that by the time you finish your dissertation 15 years from now, you will at least be in line for what will be a part-time temp teaching position, and eventually maybe achieve the holy grail of the tenure track position. How does that feel?
That's very good. Thank you. I'm glad I called.
I'm glad you called too, Michael. Thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Bye.
And that is the show for today. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, to all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do three-minute workovers on callers. And the Occupy movement has been criticized for a lack of specificity. What slogan would you put on an Occupy poster that would most improve the American jobs situation? What would you say on a counter-Occupy poster? My wife, Barbara Nemco, and I are going to offer our slogans, and we will invite you to call in with yours. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.